Military players in Sudan are turning against each other. They were partners in a coup that ended a short-lived coalition with civilians. But now each side is vying for more power. So, could the standoff grow into a civil war? And what does it mean for the future of Sudan? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. After years of instability and coups, fears are growing of another armed conflict in Sudan. The paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, has deployed fighters to major cities. The army warns the move could fuel divisions and threaten security. And plans to sign an agreement for a new transitional government have again been delayed. With a potential battle for power, many fear an armed conflict could turn into a civil war. Katya Lopez-Hodoyan has more.
These are not the headlines people in Sudan were hoping for. Plans for a new government are on hold yet again. Instead, focus has turned to tensions between the army and a powerful paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces. The escalation boils down to two leaders competing for power. On one side is the army led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. On the other is the head of the Rapid Support Forces, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Hemeti. This week, he mobilized troops in several cities, including the capital, Khartoum. The two generals disagree about when and how the paramilitary unit will be integrated into the armed forces. And that is a condition for the transition to civilian rule.
This redeployment issued by the Rapid Support Forces will lead to more tension and division in Sudan. It may also lead to security failures.
The RSF worked with the military to overthrow Omar al-Bashir in 2019. 2 years later, they carried out another coup. Dozens of protesters were killed in the aftermath. Hundreds were arrested. With a new government due to be appointed, the generals seem determined to maintain their influence.
We have General Burhan and General Hemeti fighting for power while we fight to find food and water. They're fighting for authority over our country and people while we fight for education and health services.
As the threat of an armed conflict grows, the much-anticipated agreement for a peaceful transition to a civilian-led government remains unsigned. Katia Lopez-Odoyan for Inside Story.
All right, let's go ahead and bring in our guests here in Doha. Walid Madibo, founder and president of Sudan Policy Forum. In Khartoum, Khulud Khair, founding director of Confluence Advisory, a Sudan-based think tank. And in Medford, Massachusetts, Alex Duvall, professor at Tufts Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and executive director at the World Peace Foundation. Khulud, let me start with you today. The Rapid Support Forces had worked with the military to overthrow Omar al-Bashir in 2019. 2 years later, they carried out another coup. Why are the heads of these groups now at loggerheads?
Well, the reality is that they've always been at loggerheads to some degree, and that's because they have very different visions for consolidating their power grab in 2019 and their coup in 2021. But the reality is that they both want to avoid accountability. They both want to avoid committing to security sector reform elements that will vastly circumscribe or curtail or limit their powers. And so there are signs that they're actually working together to escalate the tensions between them and to very publicly show this escalation in order to gain concessions from pro-democracy forces, only then to de-escalate these tensions, as we've been seeing in the past few hours, in order to maintain those concessions, particularly on reforms. And this has been a cycle of rinse and repeat that we've seen for at least the last few years now.
Walid, could you tell us a bit more about these two men, the two generals, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and General Hemeti? What else is behind this struggle as well?
They are in a real quagmire. If you take Hemeti, for example, the head of the RSF, if he decides to go with If he gives in to the demands of the public, then he may lose protection for his wealth or whatever amount he has garnered from the gold in the past few years. If he decides to go ahead with the coup d'etat and doesn't yield to the demands of the international community, then he may face targeted sanctions. So this is the quagmire of Hemeti. Likely, if you think of Burhan, if he decides to go ahead with the agreement, he is going to face the old guard, who are still in good control of the army, but if he doesn't, then he is going to face the popular revolution that has never stopped since 2019. So the personal quagmire of these two individuals has become the quagmire of the nation as a whole. Not to forget the sort of influence that they are receiving from the regional powers, mainly Egypt, that is supporting Burhan, and UAE, that is supporting Hemeti.
Alex, Waleed was talking there about what he called the quagmire of these two individuals. I mean, is that what this escalation essentially boils down to? Is it simply about two leaders competing for power?
It's a struggle for power. It's a struggle for control of the central instruments of coercion and state authority. And it's a struggle to keep intact these vast kleptocratic military business empires that exist. Hemeti is the newcomer to this. He's built his corporate militia empire up over recent years, but Al-Burhan and the whole crony capitalist system that developed around the military establishment is equally entrenched. And in fact, the immediate trigger for the coup of 18 months ago was precisely in order to halt the exposure and potential dismantling of these this sort of military commercial complex that has been sucking the country's economic lifeblood dry for so many years.
Alex, let me follow up with you about another point, because many point out the fact that a lot right now is hinging on the RSF potentially being integrated into the army. Does the stability of the country going forward depend on that?
There has to be some major reform and to the security apparatus, which every step that has been taken up to now, every agreement among the parties has involved expanding that security apparatus and paying off the soldiers in order to get them to cooperate. And that is part of this deadly cycle that has led to this entrapment and this quagmire. So definitely there needs to be some form of integration and security sector reform, but it has to be taken in the broader context that the army itself needs to be thoroughly reformed, downsized, and made into a professional army that serves the people instead of dominating them.
Khulood, you talked earlier about some of this being part of a vicious cycle, if you will. You're on the ground in Khartoum. From your vantage point, I mean, what are other Sudanese saying? Do they believe that an armed conflict is inevitable?
The thing is that an armed conflict is always possible, and in fact, it's always likely, precisely because of the struggle, the power struggle between Burhan and Hemeti, that sort of supersedes all of these machinations. The difficulty is that now they both are united in resisting the types of controls that Alex spoke about and the types of oversight from the civilians that we're seeing become part of the conversation. And so they come together, we know this very well, they come together when they need to resist reforms, to resist democratic gains by democratic actors, and then when, things don't go their way or when they start to, try and really settle into taking, rights or arms or money or influence from each other, that's when we see things heating up. And it's those sort of different impulses and different dynamics that are playing out that mean that regardless of whether there's a de-escalation or not, there is always a likelihood of a clash. What makes this particular incident interesting in Merewe is that the first time we have seen SAF come out officially, the Sudan Armed Forces, and release a statement at 3 a.m., almost calling the RSF's actions in Merewe an act of war. And that is the type of escalation we haven't seen as yet. And this is what gives people a lot of anxiety. At the same time, a lot of Sudanese recognize the trend of escalation, or tactical escalation and de-escalation, and they recognize the broader strategy to avoid accountability that this falls under. And so you have these two sort of, conversations that are happening in Khartoum throughout.
Waleed, obviously this all gets a bit complex, so I want to try to take a step back for a moment and look more specifically at the Rapid Support Forces. They evolved from militias that had fought in the early 2000s in Darfur. They are now a complex paramilitary group. I want to ask you, how powerful are they? How well-funded are they? And do they operate under their own chain of command?
They definitely operate under their own chain of command, but they, as I mentioned earlier, they are very much being influenced by the UAE because it is the UAE that gave Hemeti the machinery, the money, but again, these soldiers, they are being paid from the Ministry of Finance. They are not being paid by a UAE. So they are exhausting the finances of the country. But more intricately, I would want to say that the Hemeti and Burhan, they are recklessly and irresponsibly trying to exploit the ethnic and racial and tribal cleavages, because if you notice in their most recent announcement, the army has been calling for the public to come out and support the army. For support the army against whom? Against a body that Burhan himself and the Islamist groups that they have brought up to the public. I mean, it is Hemeti from, they are the ones who have given him all the influences and all the support. Burhan more recently gave him access to strategic positions in Khartoum. He made him the vice president of the council. He has been giving him access to the international community. So if you think of Omar al-Bashir as devilish as he was very powerful in the sense that he was putting the leader of the RSF under his own control. But now the situation has become uncontrollable, and Hemeti is taking advantage of the cowardice attitude of Burhan.
Alex, what kind of diplomatic efforts are currently underway to try to contain all this and to try to de-escalate the tensions?
There is a concerted effort. There is a troika of multilateral organizations, that the United Nations, the African Union, and the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, the Northeast African Regional Bloc. The problem with them is that the UN Special Representative is essentially a technocrat. He's not a high-level, political heavyweight. The African Union leadership has succumbed to the lure of transactional politics and is really just interested in dealing. And the same with IGAD. They're both extremely weak. Behind the next layer, which is more influential, is a quartet of players. That is the Saudis, the Emiratis, the United Kingdom, and the United States. And their problem is that there is no unity. And in fact, a key international player, which is Egypt, is not fully aligned with them. So they're not unified, and there is no overall strategy. The diplomatic task has been delegated to relatively junior officials who simply don't have the weight to sort of direct the regional traffic to get a coordinated response. This is simply not getting the level of diplomatic attention that it warrants.
Khaled, I saw you nodding along to some of what Alex was saying there. I mean, do you agree with what he was saying when it comes to the level of diplomats that are currently involved in trying to de-escalate tensions?
Yes, I mean, Alex is right that the sort of the political weight that is required both within the Quad countries and within the tripartite mechanism has been very glaringly absent. But beyond that, there doesn't seem to be a strategy that this fits into. And so, you know, the tripartite mechanism and the Quad have been working, trying to get a final agreement signed. But it's this very agreement in the process that surrounds it that has been part of the problem. This agreement, the framework agreement of last year in December, effectively codified the power imbalance between Burhan and Hemeti, which gives us these kinds of impasses, which gives us these kinds of flashpoints. And so the medicine that has been proffered, which is the signing of this final agreement, may in fact be worse than the disease, which is this power struggle between the generals. But in any case, there so far has not been enough effort at working out the broader political struggle between Burhan and Hemeti. And so there is a laser focus instead on this political agreement and its process. And these kinds of, you know, flashpoints of conflict can be treated in an ad hoc way, which is by no means helps us to figure out and sort out the broader power struggle.
Waleed, when it comes to the power struggle and the fact that it's delayed this transition to a planned civilian government, I mean, what happens now when it comes to the timeline of this transition? And where does this leave things right now?
I think we can compare the situation of Sudan to Libya. I think these two leaders, they are trying to prolong the process for as long as they can. And in Libya, it has been 12 years, I mean, the transitional period. Here, they are trying to elongate it in such a way that it may reach 10 years. But that's not the issue. The issue is if should the two leaders and the Sudanese politicians and the international community go ahead with this agreement. The agreement itself is not sustainable because it's alienating a big portion or a big majority of the Sudanese people. And if you think of the forces of freedom and change, the very few that they are that are left now in the process, they don't carry the weight that will make the government sustainable. That is one aspect. And the other aspect depends very much on the personality of the prime minister. Even if Burhan Hemeti agreed to the civilian process, the personality of the coming prime minister is going to play a very important role in the process. If it happens and they bring a weak personality, then the whole scenario is going to collapse and we're going to go into some sort of a civil war. I think the confrontation is inevitable between these two individuals. But then the outcome may be beneficial to the Sudanese people because we don't know if a third party can come along and just try to smash out all of this political chaos and military chaos.
Khulood, it looked to me like you were reacting to what Waleed was saying and that you wanted to jump in, so go ahead.
I just don't think that this all hinges on who becomes prime minister. That will only follow on from whatever political sort of ecosystem this framework agreement and its resulting process have created. No one person, no matter how capable they are, will be able to combat or even mitigate many of the challenges that we see coming out of this framework agreement process. And, but, you know, leave alone the issue of the generals and the power struggle, which I think we will see for certainly months, if not years, to come. The issue of this political process is that it has no broad-based political support. And without that, without including the very sort of large proportion of Sudanese public that came out against precisely this kind of militaristic politics, without the people who wanted to do away with it, with this kind of system and bring in a new one, you're not going to have any political individual or prime minister who's going to be able to get things done. And that is something that is very much missing from this process. This needs a much more concerted approach that deals with and engages with broader proportions of the Sudanese public who so far have not been engaged in this current political process.
And Alex, it looked to me like you wanted to jump in as well, so please go ahead.
I wanted to add one more point, and fully in support of what both Walid and Khaled have been saying, which is that any civilian government, any civilian prime minister who comes in at this stage will have a much weaker hand than Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok had when he came in almost 4 years ago, because of the relative weakness and division among the democratic forces and the weakness and division of the international engagement. And the key thing, one of the key things that unraveled that government was the failure of the international community, especially the United States, to step up to the plate and lift sanctions and provide the economic clout, the assistance that would have given real power to the civilian government. And there is so little international interest in actually bailing Sudan out of this very, very serious economic crisis, that any civilian prime minister is, however strong his character, whatever his support on the street, is going to have a very weak set of cards in his hand to play.
Walid, there are groups like the Forces of Freedom and Change, which is a coalition of pro-democracy parties, that are saying that the ongoing events are the plan of loyalists of the former regime. So I want to ask you, how much does the shadow of former President Omar al-Bashir hang over all of this?
I believe that the old guards, they do have influence, but I think it's the failure of the democratic forces to provide a futuristic vision for Sudan that is carrying a lot of weight. Do you see, total lack of leadership, absence of vision, developmental vision for Sudan, and there is a lack of comprehensiveness in the approach of trying to resolve the situation. If you look at the agreement itself, it's a historical and traditional approach of the Sudanese political elite is they try to avoid the critical issues, and they think that by avoiding these critical issues that they are going to go away by themselves. One of the main issues is the issue of the secular state. It hasn't been resolved because you do have Al-Hilu, you do have Abdul Wahid Muhammad Noor. That's a big group. If you think of Al-Hilu, he's occupying a territory that has about 1,400 kilometers with southern Sudan. If you think of Abdul Wahid, his army is sort of destabilizing Darfur and causing a lot of problems there. So the issues, the critical issues, the issues of the secular state, the issues of the ex-regime, Omar al-Bashir, as of now, he should have been handled to the ICC a couple of years ago. They haven't taken any action against him. They haven't taken any action against the criminals of the ex-regime. If you think, if you think of Burhan, Burhan could have taken a harsh stand against the old guard, the ex-regime, but instead he went and embraced them full-heartedly, and by so doing, he lost the popularity of the public. It is not that the people are standing for the forces of freedom and change, but that people are fed up with the indecisiveness of Burhan and his inability to take an action.
Khaled, from your perspective there in Khartoum, what do you hear from Sudanese when it comes to what they want to see happen and what concrete steps they believe need to be taken in order to resolve all of this?
I think everyone pretty much knows whose fault this is. I find it particularly peculiar when people say that, it's the civilians and their inability to agree that it's driving all of this. We are literally talking about a military clash between two very heavily armed actors, and all for the sake of their own personal gain. This is quite clearly a problem for these military actors and cannot therefore be laid at the feet of civilians. Sudan has a very militarized political system. We have to acknowledge that much. And therefore, any solutions to its political woes have to be related to unpicking and dismantling this this militarized system. There is room for Sudan Armed Forces that serves the interests of the public and not the interests of a certain group of actors, particularly partisan actors, Islamists, etc. And there is room for a sort of a level of reform that allows for integration of the RSF into SAF. But as long as I think we make this sort of an issue of the civilians, we won't really get there. The problem is that this framework agreement of last year has realigned, forced a realignment between what was before a civilian camp and a military camp. And instead, it's given us two camps, one led by Hemeti and one led by Burhan. And within those camps are civilians that could lead the next government. And this means that whatever sort of resolutions the civilians come up, or let's just say whatever resolution the two civilian factions come up with, cannot be implemented unless the core or central issues between the military patrons that they have are resolved. And we are not anywhere nearer to resolving the problem between the military actors. And therefore, we cannot really find the sort of civilian solutions that we've been looking for. This is the folly, I think, of relying on a final agreement between the two FFC factions to sort of steer us through this very difficult period. It's going to require much broader thinking about how to dismantle the militarized state and how to save the Sudan Armed Forces from these malign actors.
And Alex, we just have about 1 minute left. Let me just ask you real quick, what are the steps that could be taken right now? What are the concrete steps that could be taken in order to help solve this?
I think we need a much higher and more robust level of global international coordination and diplomacy. Number one, the first absolute priority is to stop an accidental or deliberate escalation into all-out conflict, which is quite possible. And then back to the reconsideration, reframing, using the framework agreement as the basis for addressing these very knotty problems that we have been discussing.
All right. We have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave the conversation there. Thanks so much to all of our guests, Waleed Madibo, Khulood Kheir, and Alex Duvall. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. For me, Mohammed Jamjoum, and the whole team here, bye for now.